A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it starts with a confession. He just bought a stack of Euroboxes for a move, and he's got that familiar twinge of plastic guilt. But here's the thing. His old IKEA bins are already warped. They smell faintly chemical, and he's replacing them after, what, a couple of years? So what if buying cheap plastic over and over is actually worse? For the planet, for your wallet, for your sanity, than buying the expensive stuff once?
That's the tension. You feel virtuous avoiding the premium purchase, but then you're back at the store in 18 months because the first bin's corners have gone soft and it won't stack straight.
Daniel's question gets at something most people never learn to read. This hidden hierarchy inside what we casually call plastic. Two bins can both say polypropylene on the bottom, both have that little number 5 recycling symbol, and one crumbles under a stack of books while the other holds a car battery for 15 years. What's actually different?
He specifically asked about that faint chemical odor that hangs around IKEA bins for weeks. Is it just annoying, or is it something to worry about? And is it connected to the same manufacturing choices that make the bins structurally inferior?
We've got two mysteries running in parallel. The mechanical one. Why does one polypropylene bin warp and crack while another stays rigid for decades? And the chemical one. What exactly is off-gassing into your garage air? And why do cheap bins do it more?
I love this question because it pulls on a thread that unravels the entire consumer plastics industry. Most of us think plastic is plastic. This generic, vaguely regrettable substance. But the difference between a $3 bin and a $30 bin isn't just branding. It's polymer physics all the way down. Molecular weight distributions, copolymer architectures, filler loading percentages.
The sustainability angle Daniel's poking at is genuinely counterintuitive. The $30 bin uses more plastic, maybe 3 times as much material by weight. Your instinct says that's worse. But if it lasts 10 times as long, the math flips completely.
There was a study from the Fraunhofer Institute last year that quantified exactly this. A Eurobox used for 15 years in automotive logistics had a 40% lower carbon footprint per use cycle than replacing consumer-grade bins 3 times over the same period, even accounting for the higher embedded energy of the better material.
40% lower. And that's before you factor in the bins that didn't end up in landfill, because the cheap ones cracked and got tossed. So, what Daniel's really asking is how to read the material science of a plastic bin without a laboratory. What separates industrial-grade polypropylene from the stuff that warps in a warm attic?
Let's start with what's actually inside these things. When you pick up an IKEA Samla bin and a Euro container, and both say polypropylene on the label, what are you really holding?
Because plastic is plastic, completely falls apart here.
Polypropylene isn't one material, it's a family. The fundamental split is between homopolymer polypropylene and impact copolymer polypropylene. Homopolymer is the basic stuff, just propylene molecules linked into long chains. It's stiff, it's cheap, it processes easily, and it's brittle, especially at low temperatures, under sustained load, or after UV exposure.
That's what's in the IKEA bin.
Now impact copolymer, that's what goes into industrial Euroboxes. Manufacturers deliberately introduce a second component during polymerization. They create tiny rubbery domains of ethylene propylene rubber, EPR, dispersed throughout the polypropylene matrix.
You've got hard plastic with soft rubber bits embedded in it.
And those rubber domains act like shock absorbers. When a crack starts to propagate, it hits one of these rubbery regions and the energy dissipates. The crack stops. Instead of a clean snap, you get a material that can absorb impacts and flex without failing. This matters enormously for storage bins. You're stacking them, dropping them when they're cold, sliding them across garage floors. An impact copolymer bin survives all of that. A homopolymer bin develops hairline cracks that grow over time.
That's the first layer. But there's more going on even within those categories, right?
The next variable is molecular weight. Picture polypropylene as a bowl of spaghetti. each noodle is a polymer chain. In a high molecular weight polypropylene, above 300,000 grams per mole, those noodles are very long and entangle extensively. When you apply a load, the entanglements distribute the stress across many chains. The material resists creep, the slow, permanent deformation that happens when plastic sits under weight for months.
That's exactly what happens to cheap bins. You stack books in them, come back 6 months later, and the walls are bowed outward like a middle-aged waistline.
And the reason is that low molecular weight PP has shorter chains, fewer entanglements, and the chains slide past each other more easily under sustained stress. Manufacturers use lower molecular weight grades because they flow faster during injection molding, faster cycle times, more bins per hour. But you pay for that in creep resistance.
The IKEA bin is optimized for manufacturing speed, not for sitting under a stack of winter coats for 5 years.
Then there's the third variable, which is what they're not telling you on the label.
Like, they're bulking out the plastic with something cheaper?
Basically, ground limestone. In cheap bins, filler loading can be 20 to 40% by weight. That's replacing up to a third of the polymer with rock dust. From a manufacturing perspective, it makes sense. Calcium carbonate costs a fraction of what polypropylene resin costs. It increases stiffness, it reduces cooling time. Everything looks great on day one. Those filler particles don't bond perfectly to the polymer matrix. They create stress concentration points. Every tiny particle is a spot where, under load, stress gets focused. That's where cracks initiate. So a bin that feels nice and stiff when new actually becomes more brittle over time.
They've made the bin stiffer in a way that guarantees it'll eventually crack. That's almost poetic.
It's planned obsolescence through material science. Industrial Euroboxes use very little filler, if any. The stiffness comes from wall thickness and rib design, not from cheap mineral loading.
Which brings us to geometry. Because even the best polymer won't save a bin that's designed too thin.
A typical IKEA Samla bin, the 65-liter one, has walls about 1.2 to 1.8 millimeters thick. A Euro container of similar volume has walls 2.5 to 3.5 millimeters thick, with structural ribs molded in, so roughly twice as thick. But bending stiffness scales with the cube of thickness. A wall that's twice as thick isn't twice as stiff. It's 8 times as stiff.
Wait, say that again. Twice the thickness gives you 8 times the stiffness.
That's the section modulus at work. For a flat plate and bending, stiffness is proportional to thickness cubed. 2 cubed is 8. So a Eurobox wall at 3 millimeters isn't just a bit stiffer than an IKEA wall at 1.5. It's 8 times stiffer. And that's before you account for the ribs.
That's the kind of number that should be printed on the label. This bin is 8 times stiffer than the one you're about to buy because it's $3 cheaper.
It explains the real-world experience. You put a stack of books in an IKEA bin. The walls start creeping outward immediately. The same stack in a Eurobox. Nothing. The material is operating well within its elastic range, so there's no permanent deformation.
Then there's sunlight. Daniel mentioned UV resistance. What's actually happening when a plastic bin sits near a window?
Ultraviolet light has enough energy to break carbon-hydrogen bonds in polypropylene. It creates free radicals, which react with oxygen, which creates more free radicals, a chain reaction that chops those long polymer chains into shorter fragments. The visible result is embrittlement, yellowing, and surface cracking. This happens to unprotected polypropylene in as little as 1 to 2 years of indirect sunlight.
The Euroboxes don't do this.
Because they contain hindered amine light stabilizers, HALS. These molecules interrupt the free radical chain reaction. They don't absorb UV like sunscreen. They scavenge the free radicals after they form, neutralizing them before they can attack more polymer chains. And they do it catalytically, meaning one HALS molecule can neutralize hundreds of free radical reactions before it's consumed.
It's a regenerative defense system.
Industrial Euroboxes typically use HALS at 0.3 to 0.5% loading. That's a tiny amount of additive, but it extends outdoor service life from maybe 2 years to 15 or 20. IKEA bins, to my knowledge, don't use UV stabilizers at all. They're designed for indoor use, away from windows. The moment they see sunlight, the clock starts ticking.
Most people's garages have windows, or they use these bins on balconies, in sheds, places where UV exposure is inevitable.
There's also an industrial standard worth mentioning. VDA 4000, the German automotive spec for returnable transport packaging. It includes a drop test from 1.5 meters at minus 20 degrees Celsius. A frozen bin dropped from chest height onto concrete. It has to survive without cracking. A consumer bin with high filler loading and homopolymer PP would shatter like glass. The Eurobox, with impact copolymer and proper wall thickness, shrugs it off.
What we've got is a materials hierarchy completely invisible to the consumer. The recycling code says 5, the label says polypropylene, and you think you're comparing like with like. But underneath, you've got homopolymer versus impact copolymer. High molecular weight versus low, filled versus unfilled, stabilized versus unstabilized, thick with ribs versus thin and flat. 4 or 5 different engineering decisions that separate a bin that lasts 2 years from one that lasts 2 decades.
We haven't even touched the smell yet.
Daniel said his IKEA bins have a slight but definite odor. What exactly is escaping from a cheap plastic bin into the air?
When a cheap bin smells, you're mostly smelling 3 things. Residual propylene monomer that never got fully polymerized, degradation byproducts from the heat of ejection molding, and the breakdown of processing aids added to make the plastic flow through the mold faster.
That sounds like something they don't advertise on the packaging.
They never do, but every plastic part has them. Slip agents, typically arucamide or oleamide, that migrate to the surface and make the bin release from the mold. Antistatic agents that prevent dust attraction. And in cheap bins, external mold release sprays, usually silicone-based, sprayed onto the mold surface between shots.
The bin comes out with a chemical film on it.
That film keeps off-gassing for weeks or months. Higher-end manufacturing uses internal mold release agents compounded into the resin itself. They're fully encapsulated and don't volatilize the same way. But external sprays are cheaper and faster. So that's what you get at the IKEA price point.
What about the plastic itself breaking down during manufacturing?
When you inject molten polypropylene at 200 plus degrees Celsius, some polymer chains inevitably break. The fragments, especially if oxygen is present, form aldehydes. Hexanol, non-anol, those C6 to C9 compounds. They're volatile, and your nose is exquisitely sensitive to them. Odor thresholds are in the single-digit parts per billion range. Meanwhile, the OSHA permissible exposure limit for propylene is 500 parts per million. So you can have a bin that's perfectly safe by every occupational health standard, and it still smells.
The smell is annoying, but not dangerous.
In the concentrations from a storage bin in a ventilated room, yes. The odor is a warning sign of lower-grade manufacturing. Faster cycles, hotter processing, cheaper additives. But it's not a toxicity emergency. That said, I wouldn't store food in a bin that's actively off-gassing. Not because it'll poison you, but because those compounds can migrate into fats and impart off flavors.
The Euroboxes don't smell this way.
Much less so. Better resin starts with lower residual monomer content because polymerization is run to higher conversion. The stabilizer package, those HALS plus antioxidant additives, protects the polymer during processing so you get less thermal degradation. Internal lubricants stay put instead of volatilizing. You might get a faint odor when brand new, but it dissipates quickly.
The smell and the structural weakness have the same root cause. They're both symptoms of a manufacturing philosophy that prioritizes cycle time and material cost over everything else.
That's the connection. Low molecular weight resin flows faster but creeps more. High filler loading reduces resin cost but creates crack initiation sites. Skipping UV stabilizers saves a fraction of a cent per bin but guarantees embrittlement. External mold release speeds up production but leaves a volatile residue. Every single shortcut shows up in both the mechanical performance and the off-gassing profile.
The consumer has no way to see any of this. You pick up 2 bins, both say polypropylene, both a vaguely translucent white plastic, and one is engineered to fail and the other is engineered to outlast you.
Which brings us to what Daniel was really circling around with the sustainability question. If you buy the cheap bin and replace it 4 times, you've used more total plastic and more total carbon than if you'd bought the industrial one in the first place.
The guilt should be reversed. The expensive bin is the environmentally responsible choice. The cheap one is the wasteful one.
That's the paradox most people never get to, because the upfront price tag does all the moral signaling.
Walk me through the failure sequence. I've got a cheap bin with high filler loading, low molecular weight, no UV stabilizer. It's sitting in my garage with 40 pounds of books in it. What's happening month by month?
Month one, mostly nothing visible. But at the molecular level, those polymer chains are already sliding. The weight creates constant stress, and because the chains are shorter and less entangled, they're slowly rearranging. The walls begin to bow outward, imperceptibly at first. Meanwhile, every particle of calcium carbonate is a rigid inclusion in a flexible matrix. When the polymer chains try to stretch around them under load, stress concentrates at the particle surface. Imagine pulling taffy that's full of sand grains.
The filler that made it feel stiff on day one is now creating hundreds of micro-tear initiation points.
And once a micro-crack forms, it doesn't heal. Each loading cycle, you add books, take some out, temperature cycles between day and night. Each cycle propagates those cracks further. After 6 months, you've got visible stress whitening at the corners. That's polymer crazing, tiny voids opening up where filler particles have separated from the matrix.
I've seen that on every cheap bin I've ever owned. That cloudy white discoloration right where the wall meets the base.
That's the failure in progress. And if that bin is anywhere near a window, you're simultaneously getting photooxidation chopping the chains shorter. The molecular weight drops, which accelerates the creep, which accelerates the cracking. It's a feedback loop.
The Eurobox under the same load?
The impact copolymer has those EPR domains absorbing stress energy. The molecular weight is high enough that chain entanglements hold everything in place. There's no filler creating stress concentrators. And the wall is thick enough with that cubic stiffness relationship that the material never leaves its elastic regime. It flexes slightly and returns. No permanent deformation, no microcracking, no cascade.
The cheap bin is designed to fail gracefully enough that you don't notice until it's too late, which is exactly what Daniel described. His IKEA bins were halfway warped. That's the creep failure. Not a sudden snap, but a slow surrender.
By too late, I mean the corners have gone soft, the lid won't seat, and the whole stack is leaning. At which point, you're back at IKEA buying the same bin again.
Now the question Daniel was really asking, is this off-gassing stuff harmful, or does it just smell bad?
It's almost certainly not harmful at the concentrations you'd encounter in a ventilated room. The aldehydes we're talking about have odor thresholds in the single-digit parts per billion range. The OSHA exposure limit for propylene is 500 parts per million. Your nose detects them at concentrations roughly 100,000 times lower than what would trigger occupational safety concerns. The smell is a quality signal, not a toxicity alarm. That said, for someone with chemical sensitivities or asthma, even low-level VOCs can be an irritant. But for most people storing books in winter coats, the primary problem is annoyance, not danger.
Which brings us to the sustainability paradox. Daniel bought expensive plastic and felt guilty, but the math says he shouldn't.
The math is surprisingly clear. A Eurobox might use 3 times the material mass of an IKEA bin. But if the IKEA bin lasts 2 years and the Eurobox lasts 15, you'd buy 7 or 8 IKEA bins in the same period. That's more than double the total plastic consumed. UV-stabilized impact copolymer has an embedded carbon footprint of roughly 2.0 kilograms of CO2 per kilogram. Basic homopolymer is about 1.7. So the Eurobox starts with an 18% carbon penalty per kilogram. But over a 15-year service life, the Fraunhofer study showed a 40% lower carbon footprint per use cycle. The durability more than compensates.
That's before you factor in the recycling endgame.
Which is where the gap gets even wider. A thick-walled Eurobox is a single material part with high scrap value. It's easily identified, easily sorted, and the recycling stream wants it. Thin consumer bins often have labels, mixed material lids, or get contaminated with food waste. They end up in mixed waste streams, and from there, landfill or incineration.
The bin designed to be cheap is also designed, inadvertently, to be unrecyclable.
The bin designed for industrial logistics, where someone actually tracks the asset over its lifetime, ends up being the one that circulates back into the material economy. It's not greenwashing. Durability and recyclability are engineering requirements in the industrial market that happen to produce better environmental outcomes. The consumer market optimizes for shelf price and nothing else.
If someone's standing in the aisle right now, staring at 2 bins that both say polypropylene on the bottom, how do they actually tell the difference without a lab?
Four things you can do with your own senses in about 30 seconds. First, flip it over and look beyond the recycling code. What you want is a UV stabilization marking, sometimes literally the letters U and V, sometimes a little sun symbol, sometimes UV stabilized in the fine print. If there's no marking, assume it's unstabilized. The manufacturer paid for that additive, they're going to advertise it. Pick it up. For the same volume, the heavier bin is almost always the better bin. More material means thicker walls, less filler, or both. Your arms will tell you in 2 seconds what a datasheet would confirm.
Heft as a quality metric.
Right there in the store. If you get that sharp chemical odor, the aldehyde cocktail, you're holding a bin that was molded fast and hot with cheap resin and external release agents. A well-made bin might have a faint smell when brand new, but it shouldn't hit you the moment you bring it near your face.
The smell test is actually diagnostic. It's not just, does this annoy me? It's, what does this tell me about the manufacturing?
Fourth, look at the walls and the base. Are there structural ribs, crisscross patterns, honeycomb sections, any geometry clearly there for stiffness rather than aesthetics? A flat, featureless wall is cheap to mold but weak under load. Ribs means someone engineered this thing to hold weight over time.
UV marking, weight, smell, rib design. And if a bin passes all four, you're probably holding something that'll outlast your enthusiasm for whatever you're storing in it.
Here's the thing about cost that flips most people's intuition. Daniel paid more up front for his Euro boxes, and that stings. But the math you should actually do is cost per year of service life. A $30 Euro box that lasts 15 years costs you $2 a year. An $8 IKEA bin that warps in 2 years costs you $4 a year.
The cheap bin is literally twice as expensive.
You made 2 extra trips to the store, and you threw away 2 broken bins, and you spent time reorganizing when the stack collapsed. The purchase price is the least interesting number.
Buy once, cry once. But not everyone's going to throw out their existing bins and start over. What's the mitigation play for the cheap stuff people already own?
First, off-gassing. If you've got new bins that smell, put them outside in a covered area for 2 to 3 weeks. The heat and airflow will accelerate the volatilization and get most of those aldehydes and residual monomer out before the bins come indoors. You're basically finishing the manufacturing process on your patio. Keep them out of direct sunlight. No window-adjacent shelving, no balcony storage without a cover. UV damage is cumulative and irreversible, and if the bin has no stabilizers, every hour of sun exposure is permanently shortening its life. Don't store food or anything temperature-sensitive in bins that are actively off-gassing. The aldehydes won't poison you, but they'll migrate into fats and starches and make everything taste faintly like a plastics factory. Use those bins for books, tools, seasonal clothing, things that don't absorb volatiles.
For new purchases, if someone's convinced by all this and wants to buy the good stuff, what are they actually looking for?
The industrial standards are your shortcut. VDA 4000 is the German automotive spec for returnable transport packaging. If a container meets that, it's passed drop tests at minus 20 Celsius from 1.5 meters. DIN 5423 covers reusable plastic distribution boxes. If you see either of those on a product sheet, you're in industrial territory. For consumer brands without those certifications, look for the phrases UV stabilized and impact modified polypropylene stated explicitly, not durable or heavy duty. Those are marketing words that mean nothing. Impact modified tells you it's a copolymer with those EPR domains. UV stabilized tells you it's got hulls. If a manufacturer put those specific technical terms on the label, they know what they're selling.
The bin worth buying is the one whose label reads like a materials science abstract, rather than a lifestyle promise.
That's a pretty good rule of thumb for most plastic products. The more technical the labeling, the more likely the product was engineered rather than just extruded.
Here's the question I keep coming back to. We've just spent this episode explaining why industrial plastic is a fundamentally different material from consumer plastic. Different chemistry, different engineering, different lifespan. The knowledge exists, the formulations are known, the additives aren't secret. So why doesn't IKEA just make a better bin?
Because the consumer storage market isn't optimized for durability. It's optimized for shelf price and replacement cycle. If IKEA sold you a bin that lasted 20 years, you'd never come back. Their entire logistics chain, flat pack, high volume, low margin, depends on products that are good enough to get out of the store, but not so good you stop shopping.
Planned obsolescence by market design, not by conspiracy.
Nobody sat in the boardroom and said, let's make these warp. But the procurement specifications optimize for cost per unit, cycle time, and shipping density. Durability at year 10 isn't in the spreadsheet because nobody's bonus depends on it.
Which brings us to the forward-looking version of Daniel's question. As bioplastics improve, as recycled content mandates tighten, as consumers get savvier, is there a version of the future where industrial-grade durability trickles down to the retail shelf?
I think there are two forces pulling in opposite directions. On one side, extended producer responsibility laws coming online in Europe and parts of North America. If the manufacturer has to pay for end-of-life disposal, suddenly a bin that lasts 15 years looks a lot better on the balance sheet than one that lasts two. On the material side, recycled polypropylene is getting better. Mechanical recycling still chops chain length, but chemical recycling, breaking the polymer back down to monomer and repolymerizing, could give you virgin quality resin from post-consumer waste. If that scales, the cost penalty for high-grade material shrinks.
The counterforce is that consumer expectations have been trained for decades. People expect a storage bin to cost $8. If the good one costs $30, most shoppers see the price tag, not the service life. The market has to educate its way out of that, and markets are terrible at education.
There's a branding problem, too. Industrial sounds like the opposite of sustainable in most people's heads. We associate industrial with smokestacks and waste, not with durability and life cycle thinking. So the bin that's actually better for the planet is the one that triggers the guilt reflex.
Which is exactly where Daniel started. He bought the right thing and felt bad about it. The entire consumer machinery is wired to make that happen.
I think that's the real takeaway here. Not just which bin to buy, but how to think about plastic at all. We've been trained to see it as a disposable substance, something you use once and throw away. But plastic is just a material. It can be engineered for a single-use fork or for a 50-year drainage pipe. The material isn't the problem. The design philosophy is.
The Eurobox Daniel bought isn't just a container. It's a vote for a different relationship with the stuff. One where you own the object long enough to repair it, to know its quirks, to stop thinking of it as temporary.
That's countercultural right now. In a world where everything is designed to be replaced, choosing something designed to endure is almost a political act.
A political act with excellent corner stacking.
No aldehyde smell.
And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1920s, the French island of Réunion cultivated a variety of wheat called Blé de la Réunion, a heritage grain traced to a single surviving seed sample brought from Madagascar in 1862, making it one of the few documented cases of an entire local wheat lineage descending from one grain.
An entire island's wheat.
That's a lot of pressure on a single seed.
This has been My Weird Prompts, thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop, and to Daniel for the question that sent us down the polymer rabbit hole. If you enjoyed this, leave a review wherever you listen. It helps. We're at myweirdprompts.com. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Go buy the heavy bin.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.